Monday through Friday at noon. It is now 1 p.m. Stay tuned for Leonard Lope at Large coming up.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Ed Schoenfeld is the owner-operator of Red Farm, Zagat's top-rated Chinese restaurants in New York City, and also Decoy, which specializes in Peking duck. For more than 40 years, he has worked in and created dozens of restaurants as an owner-operator and as a consultant, among them Chinatown Brasserie, Pig Heaven, Chop Suey Louis Lichee Lounge, and a few that didn't serve Chinese food, the Bear Cafe in Woodstock and Cafe Marimba, City Cafe and Vincent Eddie's in New York City. He joins us now to talk restaurants and whether there is such a thing as authentic Chinese cuisine. Hi, Ed, or should I say, Le Homa, or Ni Hao.
Ni Hao, Ni Hao Ba Hao. I'm good, thank you, Leonard. How are you? Nice to be here.
I'm very pleased to have you here. First of all, is there even such a thing as Chinese cuisine? Isn't it quite regional?
Well, of course there's Chinese cuisine, and it is extremely regional. And there are one heck of a lot of regions of Chinese food. And as I plow through my fifth decade, chasing after great Chinese food and, purveying it to the United States or New York City population, I've realized how little I actually know, even though I know so much, because there's so many different parts of China and so many big cities with 10 million people that have regional specialties that, you know, we never see here. And I kind of have been exposed to a great deal of it, but there's so much more. And it's changing, too.
But for a long time, almost all of the Chinese food in the United States was based on Cantonese dishes. Why was that? Was that where most of the people came from before the immigration laws started excluding Chinese people?
Absolutely. I mean, the Chinese population in the United States really dates back to the era of the California Gold Rush and the Transcontinental Railway. So you're talking the mid-1800s, 1849, 1850. You know, I'm fond of pointing out that, you know, Chinese invented gunpowder, and one would think that that's a skill that was extremely handy when you were, you know, making a right-of-way for a railroad or blasting yourself through a coal mine. And Chinese workers came to this country from the Canton region of China and the Pearl River Delta, and they brought their food with them. And of course, there are a lot of ingredients that they had in China they didn't have here, and they adapted. And
so is that why some people have called it Cantonese-American cuisine?
Well, I guess, sure.
Well, for example, dishes like egg foo young, chow mein, they're American inventions. Chop suey?
They're American inventions, but, you know, chow mein means fried noodle. Egg foo young is a corruption of a Chinese dish called fru young. It's a sauce named fru young, which is a sauce made with egg whites. So, you know, there's a basis in fact where these things started, and of course they evolved.
But you don't see those dishes in many New York restaurants anymore. Are they still found in other parts of the country?
Well, I think it depends which restaurants you go to. I mean, we don't have that many of the old classical Chinese-American restaurants that we grew up with, you know, as young people here. But I think that food is still well ingrained in the American population. And I think it's still actually pretty easy to find. I disagree with you. I think we'd have no problem going to find some chow mein or chop suey. You wouldn't find it in the high-end restaurants. You wouldn't find it in the Chinatowns that are catering to a Chinese population so much, but it's certainly there. We've been opening a restaurant in London recently, and the parallels in how Chinese food culture has unveiled itself in America and in Great Britain are actually pretty similar.
Well, it's because Britain owned Hong Kong for many, many years. It was a colony.
Right, but some of the things that are popular.
Hong Kong is Cantonese.
Right, but and some of those items that became really popular here, like sweet and sour pork, are, you know, things that became popular at the same time in the same way over there. And the move to a more authentic regional kind of cooking that's in this country taken place since the late 60s, you know, 50 plus years or so. I think you'll see that same movement in the UK, or certainly in London.
Although probably not pastrami egg rolls, which are a real favorite at your restaurant.
Well, you know, we have an Americanized approach to our cooking, and we integrate a lot of other foods that are not traditionally Chinese. And indeed, we're, I think, the largest purchaser of Katz's pastrami, and we make these Katz's pastrami egg rolls that are fantastic.
They taste Chinese to me.
Well, they are tasting Chinese, and they're made by a really great Chinese chef. And, you know, the point, though, is that our cooking, while it may be Americanized to a great extent, and it's fundamentally very – it's designed to appeal to an American customer, the basis of our cooking is rooted in fine, classical Chinese cooking technique of a very, very high order.
Do you think that it would be possible to do what would be called authentic Chinese? I had a friend who had a Mexican restaurant, and she said she hated that word authentic. And she was serving food that probably would have been perfectly acceptable in Mexico City.
Well, you know, I do think authentic is a word that has, whose meaning has changed a little. I mean, there's a lot of modern cooking that's crept into Chinese food in Hong Kong now. And it's the food that the people are eating there now. So it's authentic. But it's different than what it was 30 years ago or 50 years ago. So, you know, I've personally I've veered away from the word authentic. I'm more focused on finely wrought food, delicious food, and food that's based on quality ingredients and you know, simply really good cooking.
With the globalization of food, hasn't delicious replaced authentic as a goal? For example, you, even though we have some very fine French restaurants in New York and Japanese restaurants, many of the ingredients are grown here. They just taste a little different. In fact, a wonderful French chef told me that he preferred lobsters from Maine than from the Mediterranean. And so he liked the lobster dishes he had in his New York restaurant better than the ones he had in Paris.
Well, you know, good tasting seafood is good tasting seafood. You know, it's interesting. One of the things that I personally want to sample as I travel is local seafood. And one of the fun things for me in this past six-month period where I've been doing a little traveling back and forth between New York and London and is tasting the fish that comes from those cold waters that surround Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And so things like Dublin Bay prawns, local oysters, some terrific things.
British love a fish called plaice, which is the basis of fish and chips in most parts of England.
Right, it has an I in it.
Yes.
Right?
P-L-A-I-C-E.
Exactly. You know, I was sitting in a venerable old London fish house called Sheiky's, J. Sheiky. Been there for 100 years, and one of the things on the menu was like a big hard shell crab, weighed about a pound and a half. And boy, was that a fun thing for me to find on the menu and sit and order. It didn't require elaborate cooking, but it required great product and someone who understood how to just cook it simply and deliciously. And for me, that was, you know, a big treat.
Do you think that you would have become as knowledgeable in Chinese food if you hadn't come into contact with a number of chef emigres from China who came here in the late 1960s?
Absolutely not. I mean, my career was really driven by the fact that I had a strong interest in being a food writer and being a food authority. And early on, I studied cooking with a woman who was the doyen of cooking teachers in the United States, Grace Zia Chu. Grace Chu...
She's teaching Chinese food?
She was teaching Chinese food, and she came to the United States in the 1950s. I studied with her in the very late 1960s. She was in her early 80s. She kept teaching. She lived until her early 100s. And Grace had grown up as a very privileged Shanghainese woman, came to this country. I think she went to Vassar, which is a fairly common story in the upper classes in China. She married a man who was interested in having a political career and became friendly with Chiang Kai-shek, and Chiang Kai-shek eventually made Grace's husband China's ambassador to Russia. And Grace, during the 30s and 40s, ran the embassy there. And she gave dinner parties, and I fantasize about her feeding Stalin and people like that, and I think those was in fact the case. When the communists took over China on the 1st of October in 1949, which is a few days after I was born, Grace's husband encouraged her not to go back to China. And because she was one of the few people who possessed a diplomatic visa, she was able to come to the United States, and she started teaching cooking here.
Because we had restrictive immigration laws in those days. today, they might have problems again.
Well, it's a very different atmosphere with immigration now, but indeed that's true. But we had the act that restricted Chinese emigration to this country, the Chinese Exclusion Act. And I think it was in 1883. I wasn't around then. I don't know. You may have the date off slightly, but very few Chinese people came here. And in fact, that's the reason that we really never developed regional Chinese cooking beyond that Cantonese derived American food. And when Grace came here, started cooking and teaching, and she was quite a famous teacher, but she wasn't a very good cook. And it really sparked my curiosity. She had run an embassy, she had a staff, she had professional chefs who worked for her. So she knew how dishes should taste, what they should look like, when they should be served. She understood the culture of it. But the fine little points of that a great professional chef would know was something that she never really learned. And we changed the immigration laws in this country in the mid to late 60s, I think 65 or 66. And
you say that a big part of the story of Chinese food in the 20th century is China becoming communist. But didn't that undermine the diversity of the Chinese food?
Without exception, clearly it undermined it. I mean, when you go look at the early part of communist rule in China, and you talk about the Great Leap Forward, which was the program to modernize China, people, among other things, had to give up many of their metal objects. And that meant in people's homes, they gave away their woks and their knives and their They stopped cooking. They started eating in communal kitchens. Chefs who typically worked for patrons, great chefs I'm talking about now, didn't work in restaurants. They worked for wealthy people. They worked for, like, one of my teachers was the chef to one of China's greatest painters. When the wealthy Chinese fled China because of communist rule, they tried to grab chefs and take them with them. Mm-hmm. And they did. A lot of them went to Taiwan, Hong Kong, other places in Southeast Asia. They didn't come here. But when we changed our laws 17, 18 years later, a lot of the wealthy Chinese showed up here and their chefs came with them. And it's this group of chefs who, when I was curious and wanting to learn about this food, came to this country, and I fell in with a group of four or five chefs because I wanted to set up banquets as a way of learning about higher quality cooking. And I was lucky enough to fall in with really some of the great chefs of the 20th century. And I got an education that, frankly, I couldn't have gotten in China at that time.
I'm speaking with Ed Schoenfeld, who is the owner-operator of Red Farm. Actually, there are two Red Farms in New York, one in Greenwich Village and one on the Upper West Side, and also Decoy, which is a restaurant that specializes in Peking duck and some other things. This is Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Wasn't Uncle Tai's Hunan Wan a restaurant that you were one of the creators of one of the New York's first Hunamis restaurants.
Yeah, we're going back now to the really earliest part of my career. In 1971, 70, 72, those are the years that I was setting up Chinese banquets, and I met a group of chefs, and one of the people I met was a restaurateur who employed these chefs.
David
K. David K, K-E-H, who was educated in Taiwan, but grew up in Anhui during the Japanese occupation there. And he was very instrumental, along with a couple of other restaurateurs, in introducing the United States to authentic regional cooking. And in his case, he was one of the few people responsible for bringing authentic Sichuan food to New York and to this country. And
neither of those had been around earlier because we were pretty much stuck with the Cantonese food, which is very good food, Cantonese.
Well, if there's a good cook and the food stuff is good, then it's good food. You know, there's good chow mein and there's bad chow mein.
You received 4 stars from the New York Times.
Yes, our restaurant did.
Yes. Well, but that's rare for a Chinese restaurant.
You know, the story of Uncle Tai's and the introduction of Sichuan and Hunanese cooking really is a big part of the story of a, you know, really good high-level cooking coming to the United States. And essentially, there were a couple of entrepreneurs in New York City. One of them was a chef named T.T. Wang, who in the early 60s had started the Shun Li restaurants, which still exist, which, in fact, the Shun Li dynasty back in, I'm going to say, 64, was the first Chinese restaurant to get 4 stars from the New York Times.
These restaurants were not in New York's Chinatown.
No.
This is before Flushing.
Oh, yes, yeah. Chef Wang's story was he had been the chef to a gentleman who was an ambassador of Taiwan. First, this gentleman was the ambassador to Tokyo and then got transferred to Washington. And Chef Wang came with him. And we're talking in the early 60s. And because Chef Wang had a diplomatic visa, he had the realization that he could stay in this country and open, you know, an authentic Chinese restaurant. So Chef Wang was actually trained in kind of Eastern regional cooking, actually Yang Chow cooking. And he was a remarkably talented, you know, like 3-star Michelin chef. And he jumped ship in Washington in the early 60s. He opened a restaurant that he called Shun Li. He opened a few of them. He opened one on 23rd Street and another one on Broadway and 90th Street that people don't really remember or know about. The one on Broadway is where Carmine's is now. And then in 63, 64, he got the idea for opening a fancy restaurant. And he hired a very famous American designer of homewares and tabletop wares, a man named Russell Wright, a really iconic gentleman. And
great designer. He even designed locomotives. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. Yeah. But he designed absolutely everything at the Shun Li dynasty that opened on 48th and 2nd. I'm guessing that restaurant opened in 63. And it was a fantastic, beautiful restaurant with gold streamers and separate tables and customized ashtrays that were, I can remember them now. They were these red enamel ashtrays with logos. People stole them like you can't imagine. I remember once years and years ago going into a Japanese restaurant and all the ashtrays were from the Shun Li dynasty. And I got a, you know, big kick out of it. But Chef Wang was really the first person, along with Cecilia Sun Chang in California, who really attempted to open a, you know, what we call a high-end Chinese restaurant.
Although there were a number of them in Canada because Canada didn't have restrictive immigration laws. But Uncle, you wore a blue polyester tuxedo when you worked the front door of Uncle Tai's. Is that an authentic look? And were people surprised to see you and not somebody Chinese at the door?
Well, I think that the Caucasian customers were surprised, but the Chinese patrons were incensed. I was in my early 20s, and essentially David Kay, who had opened Sichuan restaurants along separately and in competition with the Shun Li restaurants, thought it's time to try another regional cuisine. Sichuan restaurants were starting to explode, and he came up with this idea, along with another individual, of going back to Taiwan and looking to see what would the next exciting regional cuisine they could bring to New York was going to be. And ironically, the other person was T.T. Wang from Shun Li. They both went to Taiwan in the early 70s looking for something to emulate. And independently of each other, they both found the same restaurant, and they both decided to copy this restaurant, and they both looked for chefs who worked there, and they both found chefs who worked there, knew those recipes, and they came back to New York with the idea of introducing New York to Hunan Chinese cooking. The restaurant that they emulated was called Peng Yuan. Peng was the name of the chef. Yuan means garden. And Chef Peng had been, before the communists took over China, so we're talking in the 40s now, the chef to the governor of Hunan, who was a famous gourmet. And he was renowned for being into food and having big dinner parties and hiring good chefs. And he developed in his governor's mansion a series of kind of Chinese banquet dishes that were in the style of the Hunan world of flavors. And each of these guys came back to New York, Chef Wang and David Kay, each had chefs, and they opened restaurants just weeks apart from one another. And each restaurant got reviewed by the New York Times, and each restaurant got 4 stars. Mm. And they each were selling dishes that had never been served in New York before. And the most famous dish that came out of those restaurants was General Tso's chicken, which General Peng had, that Chef Peng had made famous in Taiwan. And, we were, involved in introducing that cooking to the United States.
Well, how different is Hunanese food from Cantonese food or Sichuanese food or the foods of Fujian, Shanghai?
Well,
is it spicing?
Well, this is not my area of expertise 100%, but there's a great commonality of technique from one area to the other. So
everybody,
we're talking about steaming, woks, steaming, deep frying, cold dishes. I mean, in this most simple sense, and they almost all use the same ingredients, or many of the same ingredients. So in Sichuan food, for instance, you have heat from hot pepper. There are different types of hot pepper, and you have salt. But you also have this balance of sweetness and tartness. When you look at Hunanese recipes that are somewhat similar, usually those are much more on the tart side and have much less sugar. So there's a much more hot and sour part to Hunanese cooking. And things that they're famous for instance, the Hunanese chefs were all making what they call larou, preserved meat, which essentially was smoked meat. And you didn't see that in Sichuan food.
I always wondered what Sichuanese food must have been like before the Columbian Exchange, because there were no chilies in Asia. They came from Mesoamerica. They had a major impact on Thai food and on Sichuanese food, but were they using peppers, or does anybody have any idea?
I'm sure people do, but I'm not old enough to to have lived then. And I mean, certainly, we have a second type of pepper that's used in Sichuan, and that's not a capsicum pepper. That it's what we call Sichuan pepper corn, mm-hmm. And that's that's not a hot spice, but that's this kind of numbing spice. And I think that's certainly, in English we call it fagara, F-A-G-A-R-A, and it's in the citrus family. In fact, there was a long time, during the 90s, where we outlawed bringing Sichuan peppercorns to the United States because they thought that it might bring citrus canker to North America and, affect our very large citrus industry.
But that hasn't happened.
It did happen, but it was reversed.
It's my sense that one of the changes is that Chinese farmers started farming in the United States as well, so ingredients could be local rather than imported from China, often canned ingredients in the old days.
Well, I think that's true, and of course we don't really have much.
Suddenly you had snow pea
farms.
Yes.
Right, and people growing bok choy and Chinese cabbage, and indeed, now that we're I'm doing a restaurant in Europe, it's interesting. Those ingredients are harder to get there, and they're coming from Asia. They're not being grown locally here. We have farms in, you know, Florida and Mexico, where a lot of our produce comes from, and we have a number of Chinese farms.
Are we also developing different styles even within New York City, for example? It seems to me now people get excited by going to Flushing to eat offal or some obscure dish. And now the Brooklyn Chinatown has become more popular as well. Are there styles developing here?
Well, I mean, when you go talk, I don't know if there are styles that are developing new here as much as there are a lot of people who've come to this, Chinese people who've come to this country from different parts of China. So we have different regional cuisines now that, and different traditions, some of which may be even familial rather than, you know, relating to provincial. So you'll have somebody whose family grew up in a particular town where they had a particular type of noodle specialty, and maybe they're, you know, hand-cut noodles where they take a big ball of dough and slice it with a knife into boiling water. And you have people who've, you know, in the various food courts that have developed in Flushing, you know, that specialize in Chinese food, you have people who have very, very focused specialties.
Do you get many Chinese people in your restaurants?
We do get a large number of Chinese people, and we actually... in Decoy in particular, had an amazing thing happen about 14 months ago, I guess, in March or April of last year. The Chinese Global Television Network sought us out, wanting to do a feature on our restaurant. They actually wanted to feature Red Farm and Decoy both. And they sent a crew to do a videotape, and We taped for a couple of hours, and then unbeknownst to me, the next evening, I looked out the window at 8 o'clock. It was 9 a.m. in China, and there was this crew again doing a live broadcast from the sidewalk in front of our restaurant. And it turned out we were on the main, kind of the Today Show of Beijing, and the correspondent out front was, you know, the morning correspondent that everyone in China knew to wake up to. And they were running this videotape and then doing a live feed. And there was an anchor in Beijing interviewing him. And they said, you know, Red Farm's one of the best Chinese restaurants in the world outside of China, which was an extraordinary thing to hear. And then during the course of the filming, they took some pictures of our Peking duck. And the anchor in Beijing said to the correspondent on air live, like, hey, I see all those Peking ducks going by on the tape. Like, did you have one? What'd you think? And this guy is a native 35-year-old guy from Beijing. And he said, you know, I didn't expect this, but to tell you the truth, the duck that I had in Decoy was maybe better than any duck I'd had in China. Well,
that must have gotten a lot of people upset in China.
You know, I don't know if they got upset by it, but it was broadcast to 230 million households. It's pretty powerful. And overnight, our clientele, I mean, I make a pun, you know, it went from the names on our little reservation list went from Schwartz and Goldberg to Wang and Ding and Dong. And it was, you know, a pretty amazing thing. And it's kept up. You know, these days, reviews are great to get. They drive business. But what really drives business in restaurants now are the experiences that your guests have. And clearly, with our Chinese guests, they have been enthusiastic enough about the food that we put in front of them. And it's been interesting enough to bring them back in droves. So we have large numbers of Chinese guests.
Well, how authentic is your Peking duck, for example? Are you doing it the same way somebody would do it in Beijing? Is it just the quality of the
it
duck?
It starts
that
off
might
at
be different?
An authentic place, but I think that we're very creative in our approach to food, but the duck is not creative as much as it is about evolved, really good cooking. Let me explain what I mean. when you make a Peking duck, essentially it's a not really much of a flavored bird. It's a kind of a simple bird that is treated in a way so that you can roast it so that the skin is very crunchy. In order to do that, you get a bird that is fresh killed, has head and feet on, and you actually blow it up like a balloon. And it, and this is before you cook it. And then you do that so that the people think it's so that you get the fat to separate. But it's not really that. Actually, the fat and the skin separate together. The fat stays with the skin. And when it cooks eventually, it enables the fat to render in a different kind of way. Most places take that duck and they paint it with a little syrup. They dip it in boiling water, which makes the skin tight. They paint it with a syrup that has a little vinegar and a little sugar in it, and then they hang it up to dry. Drying poultry skin, drying a duck or a chicken, whether it's Chinese or Western, it's a really good trick to get a crispy-skinned bird when you roast it. We, however, take that, and we take it a little bit further, because after we blow up the bird, we take the cavity of the bird and we season the inside very heavily. We put in hoisin sauce and soy sauce and cinnamon and star anise and five spice powder and big chunks of ginger and scallion. And then we hang the duck up for 24 hours and let the skin dry. And it's kind of like a seasoned brine, but it's only on the inside of the duck. You don't want the outside that way because you want the outside to just have this little sugar vinegar coating so that it'll cook crispy. But the fact that we season it on the inside makes the salt denatures the salt in it denatures the meat, which means it makes it tender. It's very, very juicy. And we're improving the cooking. Now, when we cook the duck, we actually butcher it in a very unique way. We have two people cutting the ducks up. Some restaurants, many restaurants, butcher them at the table in front of the guest. We don't do that because we feel we can get a better product by doing it in the kitchen. And one chef just takes off big strips of skin, turns them upside down, and puts them on a piece of linen, while the other chef cuts up the meat and a little of the skin that we leave attached. Because we cook our ducks fresh and because they're raw when we start, they're very, very juicy. And just like cooking a turkey or just like cooking a roast beef, when it comes out of the oven, we let the duck sit there and let the juices flow back into the meat. We cook our ducks to order for our guests, but we let the ducks rest once they're cooked for about 20 minutes so that they get especially juicy. As soon as the guest is ready to get it on the table, we re-crisp the skin, the whole duck, by a few methods. We sometimes use a blowtorch, or we do a very traditional method and we take boiling hot oil and pour it over the outside of the duck. When we butcher that duck now, that meat's really juicy, and that juice is the enemy of the crispy skin. If it gets on the skin, it denatures it. It makes it soggy. So our chef, our skin chef, if we call him that, he takes the pieces, turns them upside down on a piece of linen, pieces of skin, so that they don't get soggy and they stay very crisp. And if there's any juice at all, it gets absorbed. Then we put the meat on the plate. And what do? We make this great duck consommé that we serve, a little shot of, along with the Peking duck. And we make it with duck bones and actually with miso. And it's profoundly, deeply flavored. It's like the ultimate ramen broth. And when we put the duck on the plate, we take a drop or two of that reduced broth and put it on each piece of meat. Then we take a little sea salt and put a little sea salt on top of each piece of meat. So to me, the way I describe this is what someone who's a very good cook, who's seen different kinds of cooking, would do. So when this comes out, it's not obvious to the eater, but it just tastes better.
And it is very labor intensive. We are talking with Ed Schoenfeld on today's Leonard Lopate at Large. He is the owner-operator of Red Farm, Sagat's top-rated Chinese restaurants in New York, one uptown on Broadway, the other one downtown on, is it Hudson Street?
It is, but you know, I want to correct you. Red Farm used to be the top-rated Chinese restaurant in Sagat.
I'm sorry.
And these days, Decoy is the top-rated restaurant. Okay. So we replaced ourselves. So, and of course, we're very proud of that.
Chop suey, chop suey. Living here is very much like chop suey. Hula hoops and nuclear war. Dr. Salk and Georgia Gabor. Harry Truman, Truman Capote, and Dewey. Chop suey.
Chop suey.
Chop suey from Flower Drum Song.
Excellent, excellent.
The Chinese comment on American cuisine. For many years, one of the things Americans liked about Chinese restaurants was the food would usually taste pretty good, and the meals were quite inexpensive, and then there was also the luxury of delivery and takeout. Well, there's still a lot of takeout delivery, but what you just described with the Peking duck, it doesn't sound like you can be all that inexpensive and still do that. So is there a divide between the better Chinese restaurants or the more ambitious Chinese restaurants and the old-fashioned takeout restaurants?
Well, you know, one of the...
And are people surprised when they look at the prices on some of the menus of the better restaurants?
They used to be.
Do they ask about whether there's any MSG?
Boy, you know, it's so interesting. You asked a few questions.
Yeah, I'm going to be quiet for a while.
Let me get to them one by one. Let me go backwards. 1973, we opened Uncle Ty's. We fed 300 people. 299 of them asked about MSG. The last time someone asked me about MSG in my restaurant, I can't remember when. And personally, I like MSG. We don't use it. It's not a necessity. But pretty
well,
interesting
is it?
Ingredient.
It enhances the flavor?
You know, it's...
Monosodium glutamate?
Monosodium glutamate was discovered by Japanese scientists in the early 1900s. It was...
So it's an umami thing.
It's an umami thing. It's a glutamic acid. It's something that is in many of the foods we eat. It's, you know, famously in Parmesan cheese.
My favorite cheese.
I think that for a lot of people, for a lot of Chinese chefs, who maybe didn't have the best skill set, it helped, you know, kick things up a notch, made things taste good if they didn't know how to make it taste good without it. These days, people ask constantly about something, which is gluten. You know, we have gluten, you know, every one of our waiters has a list of gluten-free dishes, and people want to have low carbohydrates, you know.
You must have some vegetarian dishes as well, and maybe even some vegan dishes.
We're actually immensely friendly to gluten-free people, to vegetarian eaters. It's a critical part of the business, not just in Chinese restaurants. So for everyone's eating that way these days. Even I am. You know, I've been watching all my carbs very much so. You know, being responsive to your customers' needs is kind of the heart of hospitality and the core of our business. So whatever that need is, you know, I'm very fond of people contact me. We don't take reservations at Red Farm, and they say, well, can you get me a table? And of course I can get them a table. And if people reach out to me, you know, my answer is always yes. Like when people ask us if we can do something, I want to try to please them.
Does Chinese cooking mostly rely on prep work? How long does the actual cooking in the wok tend to take?
Well, not all the dishes are cooked in woks, first of all. But wok dishes,
some are steamed.
Some are steamed. Some are deep fried. Some are roasted. You know, Chinese people didn't have ovens in their homes, so there were roast shops or restaurants for roasting. But, a stir-fry dish does require a great deal of preparation, and the cooking is extremely quick. In a restaurant setting, a dish can cook in 60 seconds. In a home setting, that same dish might take 5 minutes because we have such high heat in a restaurant. Things that steam take a little bit longer. But it is a cuisine that's very well adapted to someone coming into a restaurant, sitting down, and, getting fed quickly, you know, and which is a good thing for business. You know, we in our industry, we want to seat our guests down. We want them to have a good time. And then we hopefully, unlike a European restaurant where they have one seating, we the economics of the business in the United States dictate that we refill our seats as many times as we can.
How did those restaurants that I grew up with keep their prices so low? This, and I could say the same thing about Mexican restaurants, I think. Was it labor, or were they using inferior ingredients?
Well, I think a lot of Chinese restaurants, certainly not all, but many were mom-and-pop businesses. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't that much paid labor. For many years, there was a tradition of the Chinese operating within their own culture, which for better or worse meant probably not reporting all their income, having a bit of a cash business, kind of things that none of us would, you know, with my background, would ever think of doing. But, you know, indeed, you know, that's a reality of your life if you're a Chinese restaurateur, that if Chinese stay within their own community, they work by their own rules a little bit. And they have ways of making a little more money.
Time Out New York voted Red Farm Steak the best in the city. I don't think of steak as being very Chinese.
Well, you know, steak is one of those things that I think the world of Chinese food has embraced. Chinese food is cut up into shapes, typically, you know, in protein and beef. You know, you have si, which is a shred, and dice, and qiu, which is a chunk, and pian, which is a slice. Steak is a whole big hunk. You know, Chinese food wasn't cooked that way. But, you know, it doesn't take a lot to come to this country and have someone serve you a big steak and like it. So in the case of Red Farm and the meats that we serve that way, our head chef, Joe Eng, who actually is a dim sum, a dumpling chef, came to this country from Canton, and he decided that he was a young guy and he wanted to have a good social life, and he decided that, oh, Americans love barbecues. If I could learn to cook a really big barbecue, I could get myself a, you know, fun time. So he made it a point of taking the Cantonese marination techniques, which are unique to Cantonese Chinese cooking, that are really astoundingly good at marinating meat. And he applied that to steak and pork chops. And the results that he's been able, that have evolved out of his work, are just sensational. So, you know, when you take that and you introduce them to a piece of prime-aged American beef, and then you tenderize it the way he does and flavor it that way, you get a pretty superb product. We have the owner of one of the most famous steak restaurants, if not the most famous steak restaurant in New York City, comes to our restaurant every few weeks and orders a steak. It's astounding. You know, I don't want to say his name on the air, but
Peter Luger's guy?
Could be, you know. But, you know, people come to our restaurant, and indeed there's a Time Out New York not only stated that, when that issue was published, they made a cartoon, a centerfold, and we've reproduced it because it shows me as a 60-year-old Jewish superhero of Chinese food. I you know, I never really thought that I was going to be an action figure, but especially today when, you know, that's the epicenter of our movie industry, what a great thing to have in our restaurant.
Yeah, previous restaurants all had names that referred to China or Chinese food, but Red Farm, Decoy?
Well, I don't think they're hard to understand how they evolved.
What, the Red Farm being a communist thing?
Well, you know, in our age group, yeah, Red was communist, but I think much more generically Asian to a younger generation. And, you know, one of the big movements of our times with food all around the world is, you know, better quality, fresher seasonal produce and products. And it's certainly one of the things that was not the core of Chinese restaurants. I mean, you mentioned a few minutes ago how vegetables were in cans, water chestnuts were in cans, and bean sprouts. And you know, I'll never forget the first time I tasted a fresh water chestnut and realized that it was actually sweet and tasted more like an apple than a potato. So, you know, it seemed very clear to me that a really smart way to go was to have a more ingredient-driven Chinese restaurant, and that would be something that is appealing to the public's taste and something, you know, something that whose time had come, you know. So that's where Red Farm comes from. And, you know, Decoy was, just came out of the use of decoys with duck hunting. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, Red Farm, we, you know, we haven't spoken about it yet in our little talk here, but Red Farm is, among other things, a restaurant display that displays a real sense of humor. And it's very apparent in the dim sum work of Joe Ang, my partner, because he makes something that's kind of rarefied. It's called figurative dim sum. And what it refers to is him crafting dumplings that look like things. So, you know, we've had 250 million hits on the web on photographs of our shrimp dumplings because they look like Pac-Man and ghosts. And Joe creates about 150 dumplings that look like 150 different animals. And that's where his level of craft comes in. His ability to do that is remarkable.
Ed Schoenfeld is my guest on today's Leonard Lopate at Large. We're talking about Chinese food, and I'm glad you brought up dumplings because some food concepts seem to be almost universal. And I remember when some Chinese restaurant menus described wontons as Chinese crepe locks or raviolis so that people
they
would
are.
Know what they well, why do you think the idea of wrapping meat, cheese, or vegetables in a dough wrapper can be found in so many different cuisines around the world?
Well, I mean, it's certainly a good way to take what you have in it and extend it. You know, so rather than everyone having, you know, four big shrimp, take those four big shrimp and chop them up and mix them with some bamboo shoots and flavorings and, you know. Make shrimp dumplings. You know, it's like it's what the French would call a farce, right? Or force meat. It's very, you know, it's seen every place. I mean, you see it in Russian food and Georgian food and Uzbeki food and Japanese food. And I mean, we have oxtail dumplings that I think are just fantastic. They're deep fried. The oxtail is braised. It's a little bit spicy. It's pulled off the bone. And they're essentially empanadas. They're a half moon. They're clipped on the edge, pushed together on the edge. And,
so what makes them Chinese? Is it the spicing?
It's the skin. It's the filling. Mm-hmm. It's the spicing. But, you know, when I have an Italian customer come in and I can tell him, you know, it's coda, you know, the word for oxtail, which is very common in if you go to Rome or... you know, this Hispanic customer, you know, have rabo. You know, it's something that it's actually very good for selling and explaining to people and giving them something that might not be familiar and making it very approachable. And approachability in our business, you know, Chinese food was known as the place where esoterica reigned. Mm. And Red Farm and Decoy is the place where we've had things that are very approachable to Westerners, but we make them in a way that is very Chinese, but very delicious.
So you just mix dishes from all over the various regions. Dim sum is largely Cantonese, at least the dim sum restaurants that... I have known, but then you also have Shanghai soup dumplings.
Yeah, we do have different regional cooking, but our chef and most of the members of our culinary team, the Chinese ones, are Cantonese. And so from my perspective, I think that our chef prepares soup dumplings, which are Shanghainese originally, but with a little bit Cantonese point of view and a Cantonese twist. So he's making a little bit different skin. He's making a little bit different filling, you know, from his own perspective.
What about noodles? Are Chinese noodles much different from European noodles and pasta?
Well, they are and they aren't. You know, the Chinese make noodles from many more kinds of flour than we see in the West. So... wheat has gluten in it. So many people don't want to eat gluten now, but if you come to ask us, can I eat a dumpling? Well, we have many dumplings that are made from tapioca starch and potato starch.
Is rice glutinous?
glutinous rice is glutinous. But, you know, it's a most people don't realize, but most most rice flour is not used to make dumplings. We have almost no dumplings that are made with rice flour. The dumplings that you see, like shrimp dumplings, which we call har gow, or those dumplings that have a kind of a translucent skin, those are typically made with tapioca flour, and usually a combination of tapioca and potato flour, potato starch, really, and something they call wheat starch, which is made from wheat, but it's just the starch component minus the gluten.
If I remember, there was a Chinese chef who'd grown up in San Francisco in a family that had a restaurant, but he became interested in French food. And for a while, he was he worked with Jean-Georges, and he became one of the top chefs with Jean-Georges doing French food. But then when he left Jean-Georges, he decided he was going to try to learn Chinese food, and he went to one of the restaurants in Chinatown. And they decided to show him how to do certain things. And he didn't speak a lot of Cantonese, and he had a nickname. And the chef who was teaching him kept on using this nickname. This is a pretty famous chef who was the number one chef in a couple of Jean-Georges restaurants.
I know the gentleman yeah. you're talking about.
And he asked somebody, well, what does that nickname mean? And it turned out it was almost okay.
Well, you know, there's a lot of irony in the names that nicknames that Chinese people call one another. I have some nicknames. One nickname for me.
Are there some you could say on the air?
Oh, sure. You know, for years when I was wearing that blue polyester tuxedo, I looked like a hippie guy with a big, big beard. And they called me Big Beard, Da Fuzi. And just yesterday I made a joke to someone about a Chinese waiter I know who works in a Vietnamese restaurant near my home in New Jersey, and he had grown a little beard, and I looked at him and I pointed and I said, Xiao Fuzi, little beard, and he cracked up. He left for 5 minutes that I would know how to say something like that. We had a waiter whose nickname was Male Pubic Hair. And it was, they called him that in Chinese. The customers didn't know, but I spent years like hearing them call. And one day I said, you know, what does that mean? And body hair to Chinese people is a source of jokes. And there are a lot of cute little names. So
when you are not eating at your restaurant and decide to eat Chinese food, do you go to Flushing? Do you go to the New York Chinatown? Are there restaurants that you think are still pretty good?
There are some pretty good Chinese restaurants in Flushing and in Chinatown. I enjoy Lucky Eight in Brooklyn's Chinatown. There are certainly places in Queens that are exciting. But, you know, the Chinese chef world has kind of turned around, gone backwards. When I started in the business, and for 20 years after that, many Chinese chefs who could come to this country would come here because they could make a lot more money. And they'd come here and send the money back home to their families. Now things are different. Now they make more money in China. There's a lot of affluence in China. And people have money to spend. They spend it on food. So a Chinese chef, why would they come here? They leave their family. If they want to get away from their wife, they might come here. But aside from that, I mean, they can make twice as much in China as they can make in New York. So it's become hard to find skilled labor in our industry. Now, what's happened with the growth of Chinatowns like Flushing in New York and other cities in North America is those communities are much more oriented to feeding an Asian customer, to feeding a Chinese customer. So the food available, there's simply different.
I wonder if the new tariffs being imposed on China are going to have much of an impact. I understand that China, in retaliation for some of the tariffs that we've imposed, has put tariffs on things like chicken feet, which American farmers were supplying China with, soy, for example.
Well, you know, the Chinese were very worried about parts of their food supply. And over the last few years, they one of the things, as they got money, they started buying up American food businesses. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Smithfield Foods, famous, you know.
They make hams.
Yeah, purchased by Chinese people so that they could ensure themselves of a good supply. And it's driven up the prices of some commodities that we use that were very cheap. You know, short ribs get shipped over there, and the price of skirt steak and flank steak, I mean, skirt steak because of fajitas too, but, you know, things change.
One other thing that seems to have changed is that as people become more affluent, they put more meat in their food. Wasn't there a time when if you had meat in a Chinese dish, it was there just as one of the flavorings rather than the dominant ingredient?
Well, I think that was certainly true of Chinese-American food, and I think it still is true to an extent. I mean, many, many Chinese dishes are different than Western dishes. You know, they are a mix of protein and meat and vegetables. And, you know, Western food is fundamentally different than that. You have your protein on the plate and typically a starch and a vegetable.
Separate instead of all cooked together.
On the side.
Ed, it's been a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It's my pleasure.
And that brings us to an end to today's show. My great thanks to Ed Schoenfeld, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, and to Jesse Lent, who makes things run smoothly here. Join me on Monday and every weekday on WBAI from 1 to 2 p.m. And you can also hear past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org, or we're available as an iTunes podcast. I'm Leonard Lopate. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on Monday.
Right, stop right there, because the date has changed for WBAI's comedy show from July 2nd to August 6th at 8 p.m. $13 admission helps support WBAI and includes a $3 credit towards food or drink at the cafe. Come for fun, come for music, come for laughs, come for raffles, but just come. And if you sign up that day to become a BAI buddy, admission is free. That's Monday, August 6th at 8 p.m., the Commons Cafe, 388 Atlantic Avenue, 8 p.m. Be there. Find us on Facebook at Too Raw for Radio.
The new date for Too Raw for Radio is now Monday, August 6th at 8 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue in Borough Hill, Brooklyn.
WBAI is not only a progressive free speech radio station, but it is also your opportunity for several perks through the BAI Buddy System. Becoming a buddy is simple. Donate as little as $10 on a monthly basis, thus forming a relationship that benefits you, the listener, and us here at 99.5 FM. After becoming a buddy, you'll receive a WBAI tote bag and a membership card that enables you to enjoy discounted services at Zipcar, Bacchus French Bistro, Revolution Books, and more locations in the New York region. Simply visit give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. And donate today. We are a listener-supported radio station. But as a buddy, WBAI can also support you.
And once again, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The previous program was Leonard Lopez at Large, heard Monday.